You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. Register now for PASA's 2023 conference in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, featuring more than 90 sessions on farming and food systems, as well as mixers and meetups and a trade show. Learn more at pasafarming.org/conference.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is BB Gritz. We'll talk to BB about art, wine, and more. We'll taste the red and white from BB for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Benrubi. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio. We bring wine to the people. Not your typical winemaker. BB Gritz was surrounded by a family of visual artists studying art, not wine. He grew up in a medieval castle around Tuscany, surrounded by vineyards. With no formal training, BB started making wine in the late 1990s. And by 2000, he was making his own wine with a passion for old vines, Sangiovese, and eventually white wines. Merging his two loves of art and wine, BB has designed the labels for his highly sought after and critically acclaimed wines he now makes right outside of Florence. Welcome to the Grape Nation, BB.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for doing the show with us. All right, so we have a lot to talk about. I got a lot of things I want to talk to you about. But I want everyone to know who you are. So I want you to give me a brief background on your journey in life and wine that got you to your own winery. So the first thing I want you to talk about, because like I said, you have an interesting story, is tell me a little about your parents and their influences, because I think who they are, what they are, where they went, what they were doing, had a big hand in what you were doing now. So tell me a little about your parents. You know, your dad is a prolific sculptor. So set me up with that first.
Well, my father is a sculptor, has been a sculptor all his life. He's 94 now. And my mom has been a mom for four kids and a wife of an artist, which means
right.
a handful.
Right, right.
And for sure, now when you are a son of an artist, you don't really have, I would say, a conventional education, you know, because, I mean, artists are very, very, taken by themselves, no?
Okay, well, there's a word for that, narcissist.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Go ahead.
Very narcissist. So we were practically wild kids.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had our mom loved us very much, but we had they didn't have control of us like a normal family would have. We were kind of on our own, and which is, you know, bad and good, but at the end, yeah, you make your own experience in life and you become maybe stronger. And for me, it was a good background. And I was not a good student. I was having a hard time into rules,
okay, into following authority,
into a structured situation. I was having a really hard time. So I actually started having much better life when I went off school, when I went on my own, kind of.
So I want to talk about that too. But interestingly, your dad was half Swiss, half Israeli. I would think Gidon is an Israeli name, right?
Not exactly. My father was Israeli.
Israeli, okay.
Yeah. And my grandfather came in the early 20s to live in Israel as a pioneer from Germany. And so talking, and then my mother's side, they came from Russia. On my grandmother's side, they came from Russia. So okay. And they came in the 1860s from Russia. So it's kind of pioneers families in Israel. And so he lived there, and he left Israel when he was 24 for doing the Academy of Art.
Right. So he left Israel to go to school in Italy, which is what brought him there.
Yeah. He went first in Academy of Art in Florence, then he went to the Academy of Art in Paris. And then his father, so my grandfather, decided to buy this property in Florence. And then somehow my father he didn't have any plans to come to stay in Florence, but he got kind of sucked in from my grandfather to follow this property because he was speaking Italian, and so he could help a bit. Blah, 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 blah. So I mean, he came and somehow never left. No.
So you're alluding to this
castle
or property, which started with your grandfather.
Yeah.
Then your dad went into it, and then you grew up in and around the castle, right?
Yeah.
So a couple things that are interesting to me. You know, you said growing up around artists, you know, not a lot of structure and all of that. I think later on in life and now, the way you approach, you know, wine and how you make it and how you view everything, you know, is not much different than where you came from. And we'll talk about that a little. And the other thing is, you know, here you are, you know, a famous winemaker making this culty wine with like the quintessential Israeli first name, right? Bibi?
What do you mean by that?
Well, Bibi, you know, Bibi is like Bibi Netanyahu. I mean, that's just a very Israeli name. I think it's funny, but we'll move on.
I prefer Bibi King.
Yeah, me too. I prefer listening to BB King drinking BB Gretz wine. So that's a good match. Okay. All right. So this is kind of interesting. You grow up in truly an unusual place, right? I mean, just tell me a little about the castle, which again plays into what you're doing now.
Well, you know, it's for us, we had a very, I mean, when you're living the life, you don't really think what you are, what people would look at you from outside. But I mean, us, we were living a very colorful life in the castle. You know, artists are very not taken we had a kind of a very simple life. You know, we had this amazing property, but
right.
we had a very simple life, very humble. You know?
And everything but the property was simple, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. Outside, it looked like, you know, grandiose and
right.
Like that, but in fact, we were having a very humble life and very, you know, going to public schools and having a very, you know, kind of half peasant life, you know, kind of. It was
right.
When they arrived, my parents arrived there, it was still very strong peasant culture in Italy. And all the farmers that were living in the houses, they were still there. And they had been there for generations. And I mean, my mother tells me stories where the women of the farmers were sitting with the chairs looking at the house. Now, the chair was turned towards the house. They were all dressed in black. And I mean, these were sitting there and knitting while the men were out and worked in the fields. So, I mean, it was rural Italy, no?
I was just going to say, Italian countryside.
Yeah.
You know, that was the feel. It was anything but the city. Did you wind up going to the art school that one of the schools your dad went to?
Well, actually, yes. I never thought about it, but yes.
Yeah, because when I was just looking at everything, I'm like, I think these are the same, but I wanted to ask you that.
Yeah, I never thought about it, but it is the same.
Is that the typical thing where you grow up around somebody, your dad, who's very influential to you? He's an artist. And at some point you just say, all right, you know, this is what I know. I'm going to study art. I mean, is it as simple as that, or were there other reasons you went to art school?
I went to an art high school first, and that was okay. When you're out of school, people you didn't have like open schools like now where you go and choose you were kind of directed from your teachers where to go,
right?
Kind of. And I was or going for like classic studies like Italian literature, Latin and stuff like that, which was what was a bit fascinating me. But they just told me, no, you go to art school, there's no chance you're going to manage to go to a classic school. So I just went to an art school. After I went to the Academy of Art, but I was kind of already on my own. I was not really a student anymore. I mean, I just did it like I was already into my own way, kind of. I was studying. I was working in a stained glass studio and I wanted to open my stained glass studio. So I thought, okay, well, I might as well do the Academy of Art on a side as a side thing, won't harm. But I was actually already doing my own thing, kind of. No?
All right. So tell me about that time, because you talk about art high school, art academy, you know, working at a studio and all that. But tell me about that time. Obviously, you made a departure from art. It may have been transitional, but when did you realize you wanted to concentrate on wine and, you know, maybe less art or no art? I mean, tell me how that comes about.
It kind of came slowly because first I was planning to open my stained glass studio. Then by the time I studied for like 3 years, then I went to Paris and I went for a stage in Paris and I learned to how to paint with fire and stuff like that. Then I came back and I actually prepared everything. I prepared all my studio and I was there to start. And then I just said to myself, no, I cannot sit in front of the desk for my life. It's not going to be the thing.
It came to you pretty quickly. I mean, it wasn't running up like, why am I doing this? I'm not sure I want to do this. You know, why am I going to sit in front of, you know, a desk with glass?
I just suddenly
it just hit you and myself, said, I'm not doing this?
Yeah, it just hit me. I saw myself sitting in front of the desk with a little hammer and cut the glass cutter. Said, no, this is not going to be, it's not my life, kind of.
Okay, so then what are you thinking?
And then just in that period there where I realized it was not going to be my thing, my family decided to do an activity in the castle to use the castle for doing some kind of activity for kind of self-maintain the castle or stuff like that.
Right.
And I was in a period where I said, well, you know what? Why not? I can take care of it for the moment for a certain amount of time. No, for a specific amount of time, I can take care of it with that. And so I actually started an activity that was completely different. It was launching the castle for becoming kind of a multi-central center. No? So
for events, things like that?
Events, concerts, art shows, lots of theater acts, stuff, and I mean, lots of activities. Then suddenly I found myself that I was organizing stuff for other artists to do, no? And which were very happy about it because they were having a lot of organization, a lot of stuff, and a lot of, and I was, I mean, in like in 2-3 years, it became one of the most popular centers in Florence for many kind of activities. And then I kind of...
BB, what year was that around?
We started in 92.
Okay.
And then suddenly I found myself, okay, well, I am actually organizing all this stuff for all these artists to have fun, but I'm actually not having fun by myself. I mean, I need to do something for myself. I cannot just organize for other people to have fun. No? So then slowly, I started doing some things that were more like on the creative side, like I open up a flower decoration company that was doing flower decorations. So I was playing with flower decorations and stuff, and lots of fun. We made some really huge events with flower decoration. I mean, crazy, like 10,000 roses and stuff. And blah, blah,
wow.
Blah. Crazy stuff. Because we had the cast, with the event thing, we suddenly get in contact with customers that were doing crazy things, and we did some really fun thing. But again, I mean, started and finished. And then we had this little vineyard, and we were playing a bit with the vineyard, and we had this you had this trend of wine, and we started trying to go down in the vineyard, and try to prune a bit better to see if we could reduce the crop and do some better wine. But it was just like this. We had still had the whole structure with gardeners and people that were taking care of all this thing here. And it was not really on me. It was more like, every time, once in a while, you go down and play a bit like that. But then I remember once we went, I had a friend of mine that was working at the time for Antinori, and he kind of, together with him, we went in the night with my pickup. We managed to get hold of like 3 barrels of old barrels from barriques from Antinori, so we kind of went and steal 3 barrels from Antinori's cellar.
Wait, did you steal them or they gave them to you?
No, they gave them to me. But somebody was, I don't know if...
It doesn't matter now. Okay.
I don't know if that person was really allowed to do it, but anyway, it was fun.
Right. But that's on him, not you.
Yeah.
But the 3 Antinori barrels is really the birthplace of your wines in a way, right? Getting started?
Well, we started playing and we were trying to do like better wines. And then I had a DJ that was working in the castle that was an enologist. And he was kind of putting music in the evening and helping me to do some wine. But then I realized that the guys was not really at where I wanted. And so we started looking ourselves around. And then... it was kind of a mess because first with the gardeners, we had we had 2 hectares of vineyards, and there was a system that was working completely in autonomy. So the guard, the gardener who lived there, the property, he had like, every Friday from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, he was in the cellar and customers could come and buy the wine bulk. No? And there was a system that was going on in an automatic way, and was taking care of all, they were coming with Damigianas and, there were like 15 customers and they were coming regularly to buy the wine and we were finishing the wine, like that. Then suddenly my father, I think it doesn't mean, but must have been like in the mid-90s, decided to bottle the wines with the label of the castle as a Chianti and to sell it. And he actually sold it all together to Switzerland, to a distributor in Switzerland, who bought all the wine.
He sold all of it to one place in Switzerland?
To one place in Switzerland.
It was one bulk sale. One guy got it and he was able to
distribute. One guy bought it and bought all the bottles and all that stuff.
Okay.
So, but what happened is that the guy bought all the wine and probably the wine was not to the standard and he didn't rebuy the wine.
So, that's an indicator.
Yeah. So, or maybe it not takes time to build the market also now for right. some people. So, well, at least now I know things like that. But so what happened is that we didn't have any other customer for the wine, but in the meantime, we lost all the system of the people that were coming and buying bulk. No? So suddenly there was the whole grapes, wine, it was a whole chaos. So for a few years, I decided to sell the grapes to a co-op and kind of to make up our minds and see what we wanted to do. No? So then I started doing some, trying to do some wine, some little things. We were trying to sell it at the events, the castle. It was impossible. It was kind of crazy. We tried to sell some wines. There's some friends that has distributors in Norway. My mother is from Norway, so we had a lot of connections there. And no way, no answers, no kind of, okay, not easy.
Not so easy.
So, and then suddenly this friend of mine told me, listen, I see that you're playing a bit with this wine. Why don't you go and visit my friend who has, you know, they have a fantastic vineyard in the Chianti Classico. They sell all their wines to Japan, and then they sell exclusively in Italy to this three-star Michelin, and this most famous restaurant in Italy. It's in Florence, in Ateca Pinchiori. It's really cool. You should go and see them. But I said, why not? Why don't you
kind Wait, of... it was the restaurant in Ateca Pinchiori?
Yeah.
Isn't that in like a little castle or something?
No, it's in the center of Florence. It's a three-star.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I actually went to see this winery, you know, which was a friend of this friend of my best friend. And I really got stroke. You know, I saw this guy was my age, 30 years at the time, and or 30, 33. Or he was exactly my age, and he was the son of an enologist, one of the greatest enologists in Tuscany, had studied in Bordeaux. And he was living in the property and running this property. And I really, wow, I saw this thing here. I totally fell in love. You know? So I kind of saw it and decided in that moment that that would be my life, kind of. You know?
All right. So you, up until now, you've had no formal training in wine. You had crossed paths with a few people who were involved with wine. Now you meet this guy and he looks like the real deal to you. What happens? Does he mentor you? Do you hire him? I mean, how do you get to the next steps?
Yeah, he was a friend of friend, no, friends. And we became a bit more, I started to go visit him a few times. Actually, we became closer at the time. And I asked him if he could help me because his father was a consultant, no? And he had studied enology, no? And he said, listen, okay, I can help you, but I can help you as a friend. I mean, like, I don't have time. My father don't have time to actually have another client, no? So
to be an official consultant.
Yeah, right. But I can help as a friend. So I told him, no way, you don't know me. You cannot do this thing here as a friend. Because knowing myself how the intensity of the thing would be, it would just not work, no? So I said, no way, but maybe you can help me to find somebody who can help me. You know? So then I started looking myself around, and actually I found some, through other connections, I found a group of enologists, and I asked this guy if they were at the level now that could help me. And he said, absolutely, yes, these guys are good. They can help. You know? So I hired this group. And they started helping me, and we, you know, I
that's how things got started. Yeah. Now, were you concentrating on the few hectares around the castle, or you were looking to expand at that point?
Well, listen, I started with the 2 hectares. Then I hired another 2 hectares in the same valley, in the top of the valley. And then I started searching around to find other vineyards. It was really tough at the time because we were talking about in the real, when I started, it was really the boom of the wine. It was like the,
so what was tough? Availability and price availability, was high?
Availability of vineyards. It was nearly impossible to
find. And were the prices crazy, or was just first
you
couldn't
know,
find?
It was just impossible to find vineyards because, you know, the it was the end of the 90s, you know, and it was, you know, everything that was, I mean, all the wineries were going like crazy and everything was working, flying kind of in the wine business.
Right. There was, it was a, like you said, a crazy time, a lot of demand,
like a,
lot
bubble,
of interest.
No? It was a big bubble.
Yeah.
Actually, the bubble crashed when the Twin Towers fell. No, that was the moment where the bubble, in the wine business, the bubble crashed in Italy. You know? Kind of the coincidence.
I want to talk to you about, you know, the winery and those properties. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you a few more questions. Listen, we know Sangiovese is the most important grape in the region. And it's obvious you have an affinity for old vines. I mean, if you have any signature, it's that you're an old vine guy winemaker. And you actually sought them out. I'm curious from you, because not everyone does it. What is it about older vines? You know, what impressed you early on? You know, what are the characteristics that they impart on the wines? I mean, how did you fall into the fact that, listen, I want to concentrate on wines where I could find old vines? Because, you know, BB, that's not everyone's approach.
Well, especially if you go back to the 2000. I mean, in 2000, the whole, at least in Italy, the whole wine world was just talking about new clones, high density, and Cabernet Merlot plantations.
No? Right.
So
right.
That
and
was,
that's not where you wanted to go.
No, I don't know why, but I kind of, before I actually really started to this made my choice of becoming a winemaker. Once I went to Vinitaly, just alone with a friend, or introduced to by a friend, guy from a catering company that I was working with, and I kind of went there and saw this huge wine fair. It's the biggest wine fair in the world, probably. And with thousands and hundreds of thousands of wines, there are millions of wines, different wines, and I don't know, thousands and thousands of wineries. It was like, what the hell is this kind of, no?
Right.
And so I started kind of winding around, and then suddenly I found myself in a booth where there was this gang, no? Coming from somewhere up in the north of Italy, where there was a little DOC, and it was crazy. It was fantastic. They had this. They were planting these vineyards, and in order to take part of the DOC, the vineyards should be at least 30 years old. Before 30 years old, the wines were just simple table wines. And I got so turned on by this story, I really fell in love with it. No, I said, wow, so incredibly cool, the idea of planting a vineyard and you cannot do the wine for 30 years or not.
Right.
What the hell is
so that? So that resonated with you. That was like, that's where I'm going.
Yeah, but, I don't know why, but it totally hooked me. No?
But I asked you before, what is it about older vines? I mean, what is it, a finesse? Is it, you know, what do you always walk away from when you're drinking, you know, an older vine wine?
Well, listen, it's a hard
thing to directly answer.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to directly answer. What I can tell you is in the cellar, in my cellar, when you have the older barrels, the older wines, they just somehow stick up. No, it's kind of
right.
You have this finesse. You have this. The everything is kind of. You have less power, in the wines, but you have this. they're better. It's kind of, you have
character.
You just easily understand there is a step up in the quality.
Yeah, I don't think anyone will argue with you. You know, I mean, I think people prefer, whether it's Napa or Italy or France or whatever.
So it's an easy equation, not kind of.
Right. So let's talk about, before we take a break, I want to set up a physical part. We'll talk about your wines. Let's talk about the winery first. We talked about you grew up in a castle that had a couple of hectares, and we understood how that played out. You know, that got you to where you are today, which is, you know, a winemaker, wine lover, you know, very targeted in what you want to do. But in 2019, you purchased the Hotel Via Aurora in, how do I pronounce it?
BBC? Fiesole.
Fiesole. Yeah. That you converted into your winery, your home. You'll continue the hotel and bar. I realized when I looked at that, 2019 preceded when the world stopped for COVID. Did that screw up your plans? You know, where are you at with that? And, you know, are you settled in? Are you making, you know, wine there? And I know you split between there and the castle. Tell me a little about, you know, all of that.
Well, listen, I was for many years wanting to kind of find my own home or my own place out of the castle. The castle is a kind of a family thing, and I always felt it was not my thing, it was more kind of a family thing. You know?
Makes sense.
So, but my feeling was like that in my dream, my feeling was that I would like kind of fly away, but to fly and then lay myself not too far away. No?
Right.
Because I'm very connected to this territory. But it was tough because, I mean, for me, when we started, I started a winery with no capitals. And I started with like 15,000 euros and I didn't have many possibilities in terms of finances. So I kind of developed the winery, you know, one bottle at a time. You know? So for the first, let's say, 15, 20 years, it was really tough for us to look around for a property that would actually suit and could actually be able to accommodate our necessities, you know? Because, I mean, first of all, you are looking yourself around kind of Beverly Hills here because it's the most expensive hill around Florence.
Okay.
And so every house costs millions of euros. So, I mean, and we just didn't have the money. So it was or not enough to what our necessities were. No? So we were kind of constrained a bit there at the castle. No? We felt a bit constrained. Then suddenly around 2017, no, things started really turning for us, no, in the winery, and start really growing and becoming really healthy.
So and what does turning mean? Recognition and increased sales?
Listen, it was recognition was never a problem for us.
Because okay.
From day one, I was
You got good notices.
I kind of am always a guy that make myself noticed somehow.
Always. Okay.
This is cool. I was always in the center of attention somehow, bro.
Okay.
So I don't have any problem in making myself noticed. No, kind of. But the different thing is that people, when were looking at us, they thought that we were, you know, producing whatever, you know, billions of bottles or whatever, or millions or you know, making enormous turnovers. So from the outside, it looked like that. But in fact, we were completely destructured, and we were struggling a lot, you know, with the finances and stuff and thing. It was kind of really tough the first, I mean, we were not really, it was not affecting our work or our life, but it was, I mean, the accounts were well in red in the bank, you know? And then suddenly, in the 15, I think there was a combination of you know, 15 years of or nearly 20 years of know-how. Suddenly, we started kind of learning how to move ourselves better within the world business and how to kind of, you know, work with I don't know how what happened, but things started turning well. So in when COVID came, you know, and when we actually bought the Aurora, suddenly we had a complete different economy, and we actually could. So when this thing here happened, we actually had the possibility of buying it. You know? So this was the, so when it came, suddenly we had the chance of doing it. You know? And so we really jumped on it it was 2019 before the COVID came. And then when COVID came, I mean, I don't know, we just continued our kind of, it didn't affect the winery at all. It didn't affect us at all. It just, we just continue our growth and we continue our, I mean.
Did you build a winery at the hotel?
Yeah, we created a beautiful
and
winery.
And to this here. Day it's finished?
Yeah. Well, it was we entered because we wanted to move from the castle. So when we bought the property, it was funny because we wanted to come in and the people that were owning the hotel wanted to go out. No? Right. So we kind of matched. So we bought the property in June and I think in April we brought our tanks in and we made
it. That was pretty quick.
Yeah, we kind of made a harvest without temperature control, without nothing. We just smashed it like it was a bit in the castle. It was very, right. Very.
And are you still making some of the wine in the castle? You split
between
the two?
No, now we've got everything here now.
Everything is under one roof.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's great. All right, BB, we have to take a quick break.
Yeah.
When we come back, we'll finish up on that. And then I want to talk to you, you know, specifically about the wines, the vintages, the grapes, farming, cellar practices, and all that. We're talking to BB Gretz. BB is a artist and winemaker in Tuscany and makes some terrific wines, which we're going to talk about. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Cultivate farms and food systems that nourish, heal, and empower. Register now for PASA Sustainable Agriculture's 2023 conference. Access more than 90 sessions on topics including environmental conservation, food justice, sustainable food and textile production, renewable energy, and much more. Featuring a not-to-be-missed lineup of speakers, including indigenous environmental scientist and author of Fresh Banana Leaves, Jessica Hernandez, the best-selling author of The Art of Fermentation, Sander Katz, co-owners of Heritage Seed Company, True Love Seeds, Owen Taylor and Chris Bolden Newsome, and many more. PASA's conference takes place in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on February 8th through 11th, and includes social networking events plus an expansive trade show. Register now at pasafarming.org/conference. That's pasafarming.org/conference.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, BB Gretz. BB, now that you're making wine under one roof on the hillside, that should make life a little easier. We talked earlier, not that long ago, that Tuscany is known for their super Tuscans, you know, wines that typically blend Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot, not grapes that you in the old days found around that area and that people planted. Those are not your typical Sangiovese wines. Ironically, people look at your wines, you know, as certainly culty, sought after, you know, they're super and they're from Tuscan, so they're super Tuscans too. But if I understand correctly, your 2020 vintages, which I know you love, of Colore and Testamata, they're 100% Sangiovese, correct?
Yeah, I mean, but I have been always playing with Sangiovese or with some Canaiolo and some Colorino. I mean, I never went off track there. So, I mean...
All right, wait, so help me with that. So Canaleo and Colorino are important grapes to that region. And
Canaiolo is a very important. I mean, it has been a bit lost in transition after in the transition between ancient winemaking and modern enology. It got a bit lost in transition, but if you go back to the 40s, or 50s or 30s, Canaiolo was in many vineyards also 50% of the grapes. So it was
right, and a lot of the wines were blended with those grapes, right?
I mean, it was a part, at least 30% of the old recipe of the Chianti. No, it was
right.
30% Canaiolo, but in many of the vineyards it was also 50%. No.
Right. So have you ever used Canaleo or Colorino in your Colori or Testamata?
Yeah, it was. We always used the Canaiolo and Colorino in the Testamata.
Up until this vintage, 2020?
The first time I didn't use Canaiolo and Colorino was in 2019, but up to the 18. But just for a specific reason that when for some reason it was climate reason or
right.
They were really not still ready when we made the blends, no? So
right.
They were not really adding to the Sangiovese, but they were kind of taking away, no? So for some specific reason they didn't have the blend, so I just took them out. So but It's not necessarily a rule. I mean, maybe next year we're going to...
I was going to say, I mean, I know you love the wines.
Yeah.
It doesn't convince you that from here on in, it'll be 100%. So it's not the rule. You take each vintage as it comes, right?
Yeah.
All right, so tell me about the 2020 vintage. Tell me about the wines. And here's an opportunity, because... I think you have a fairly recent vineyard plot, Olmo, and you have a handful of other ones, which, you know, we talked about are older vine vineyards. You know, tell me about the vintage, vine age. You know, are you doing the same barrel aging? Why do you love this vintage so much?
Well, you know, I have been I would say 2008. No, I was once with some friends. I was curious to taste a DRC wine. No,
right. And the Burgundy.
A Burgundy. No, and Romane Conti. No,
and wait. Up until then, you never had it before.
No, I never had it before.
Okay. Had you had other Burgundies?
Not really.
Not really. Okay.
No.
Go ahead.
So I decided to taste that wine, and we managed to buy a bottle. And at that time there, we were doing like hyper concentrated wines. Like we were really producing like 12 hectoliters per hectare. I mean, we were crazy, you know, in the sense of it was like, the wines were like rockets, not kind of. We were concentrating the sun into the glass, kind of. Now we had this idea of the concentration. It was really, really our drive at the moment.
But was the balance good? It wasn't like a big over-extracted wine, was it? I mean, you were happy with...
We were in love. We were in love with those wines.
Okay.
I mean, we were totally in love with that way of... I was totally in love with that way of making wine, and I'm kind of hard-headed, I'm kind of stubborn, so I don't really listen, no, too.
Okay.
If you don't like my wines, it's a problem with you. It's not me, Kat. You have, what's your problem, Kat? No?
Yeah, and you got a million other choices.
No, but I believe it. It's not kind of.
No, no, you're entitled to think that. You know, it's your wine. No, I don't disagree at all.
No. But suddenly, I taste this wine here, and it's the opposite. It's completely transparent, and you have this endless finesse and acidity that it was a shock for me. Because I tasted this wine here that was the opposite of what I was doing, and I fell in love with it. Completely with the idea of this, you know, transparent and super, super elegant wine. And ever since.
So stylistically, that impressed you so much. Yeah. You had the thought of, I have to think about making wines like this?
Exactly.
Okay.
So it took me years. I think the first vintage where I really managed to get there, I mean, in a way or another, because then things happen also by accident. You know, it's not that things you manage to, you do something and then by accident, and then you see, wow, no, okay, you can do that. No, and so I think it took me like the first vintage where I really reached something that was, you know, to me, a bit where I wanted to go is the 2015. It took me years. No, then
wait, can I ask you a couple questions about that? Did it ever dawn on you, or did you talk to Burgundy winemakers? Did you ever take a trip there? I mean, did you ever think of consultants, or did you figure all this out on your own?
No, I never went to Burgundy, and I never spoke to a Burgundy.
It's not the dumbest idea, you know, go to Burgundy and talk to somebody and say, hey, how do you do this? Right? Well, but I like your way.
Maybe you really figure it out. Maybe I should have met you a few years before.
Well, it's too late now, but you seem to have figured it out. And I think by figuring it out makes you a better winemaker and makes it a better wine. So it took a few years to get that quality, right?
Yeah, that kind of style. I mean, that transparency kind of, the acidity, the transparency, this thing here. But actually, the 2019 was another big step up because it was a very elegant vintage and there was a lot of production. So it really helped me to go another step forward towards kind of elegancy.
Right.
But also, it actually taught me, you know, something new, the 2019 vintage, and it was like, okay, now we are doing more elegant wines, but in fact, we have been picking nearly double quantity of grapes in the vineyards because 19 was really a very, very generous vintage. No?
Right.
So I started playing with the equations, okay, here, we need to leave more wines, we need to leave more wines in the vineyards, more grapes, we need to, I mean, so it's kind of, What I thought that I had already achieved when 2019 gave me another challenge, you know, to say, okay, here we need to, you know, drop any kind of concentrate, any kind of green harvest, and just, you know,
The first time you were in the vineyard cutting back.
It happened in the 19, no, because
right.
It was the vintage.
But you were taking less in for the sake of the grape quality, you know, all of that, right?
Yeah, we were making sure that the production would have been a bit more balanced.
Right. It was about quality, not quantity.
Yeah. It was about quality.
Yeah.
So in 19, for the first time, I was there with my guys and they said, okay, so we put down some grapes and there is too much grapes. I said, no, you don't fucking touch these grapes. Don't do anything. Just leave everything the way it is. It looks so beautiful. We don't touch anything. Okay, leave it the way it is. And the wines became so elegant. And, you know, but we were talking about big quantities per plant. Huh?
Right.
So that one gave me a new dimension and a new challenge. You know? So with 2020, what really made the difference is that we added a parcel. Which is the parcel of Olmo, huh?
which brought a quality and a characteristic that you didn't have, right?
More than a quality, no. I would say it brought in a characteristic that we didn't have.
Okay. No? Because what was that?
It's this element of freshness and transparency, no? Which I never really found before so strongly. No? So because
is that an indication of the vineyard? You know, was it a breezy, windy, elevated?
It's a place that is always windy. Yeah. And it looks like when you go over a pass in the Apennines or in the Alps, you have this, when you are in the pass, you have all this kind of flatter and softer lands, no? And you have all the grass, you have the cows, you have the mountain feeling, no? Right. This series is exactly like that, no? You have a mountain feeling and you have a cold feeling, no? A like really high elevation feeling. Although it's around 500 meters, but you have the feeling you are up in a path over 1,000 meters. No?
Right.
Same feeling. And this translates into the wines, and the wines have very, very special character.
So that was a piece of the puzzle that became very important.
Yeah, it's a piece of the puzzle that really became very important in 2020 and really changed the DNA of Testamata and Colore.
Right. That's a great story. And what'd you say? You use that in Testamata and the Colore, you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we have some older vines. We have like half plot is old vines, really old vines, and half plot is younger vines, talking about 20 years old. And the younger wines went to Testamata and the older ones went into the Colore.
Right. So besides Testamata and Colore, you do make other wines, and that's an opportunity to do different blends and use younger vines. But another thing, and I think this is important to you, is when people think of Tuscany, they don't always think of white wines. You know, they certainly think of Super Tuscans, that Cabernet Merlot we talked about, Sangiovese. You're making some interesting white wines, and there's sort of a connection to your white wines because you get the grapes from an area that you spent time as a kid, right?
Exactly.
Giglio? How do you pronounce
Giglio.
It?
Giglio.
Tell me about your wines. I mean, you make a Testamata Bianco. You know, we talked about the Testamata, the red. You started making whites pretty quickly after you got things going. So it was something you didn't, you know, hold back on.
No, I started immediately. When I started doing wine, I said, okay, I always loved the sea, no, and the water, and I wanted to do a project near the water. No, I said, I cannot remain stuck in the middle of Tuscany. I mean, I always loved the sea and I love the mountains, so I cannot just get stuck in Florence. No?
Right.
So immediately I went back to the island and started doing a project near to the water, hoping that sometime is going to bring me back to the water somehow. So the wines there, it's an amazing place. It's an incredible place. It's like a place that has an energy that is unique. It's a small, right. small island. It's, I think, 16 kilometers by three, and it's wow. 500 meters high, so it's a little mountain in the sea.
No? Right.
One hour off the coast with a ferry boat, but the terroir there, the situation when you get there, it's such a powerful place. When I got there, I got shocked. I got there. I need to do a project here, so I really started. There and I mean, if you want time, come and see it. It's one of the most beautiful places where you can have vineyards.
It sounds amazing. And the grapes, the indigenous grapes are what? Vermentino and Ansonica?
They have Ansonica plus another three, four other strange indigenous grapes, very nice. And but the thing there is about the beauty, though, but it's not only the beauty. Somehow you have terrific wines coming out of there that has, I mean, it's not only beautiful, you can also make beautiful wines, which is not an normal equation, or it's not an obvious equation. Right. With white wines in Italy. I mean,
I mean, it sounds like an interesting situation.
I think it's a matter of the climate, because you have a lot of humidity there, no?
Right.
Which creates this. It rains very, very little, but you have a lot of humidity. No? Like the summer,
from being around the water.
Yeah, like being this little mountain. It's
but
like,
that doesn't create mildew or any problems because of the sun and the wind, right?
Well, you know, not more than in Tuscany, I mean, no?
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not that you are free of the mold. I mean, you need to take care of it like if you were in another place. But there is, I think that this thing here creates this moisture that in the air, and that really create this complexity of this wine. And there is,
so BB, in front of me I have you were kind enough to send me a bunch of wines. Thank you to Ludovica and to Rebecca for helping coordinate everything. I'm tasting the Testamata Bianco.
Okay.
2021.
Yeah.
And I have it in the glass. And it's been in the glass for a while. It's opened up with a beautiful nose. And I just took another sip. The mouthfeel is gorgeous. This is the 100% Ansonica.
Yeah.
The 2021. So yeah. I've had a lot of Vermentino. I got to admit, I haven't had a lot of Ansonica. Tell me about some of the descriptors or characteristics of this grape.
Well, Ansonica, Vermentino is more kind of a wine grape. No, it has the shape, it's round,
right?
It has a lot of perfumes. It's, if you really feel that Vermentino is a wine grape, and Sonica is a bit strange. It's more like a table grape. It's more like a, it was more like a,
is it a bigger grape?
It's a bigger grape. The shape of the berries, berries, right, is like an olive kind of, no? It wow. can be it can be large like a tam sometime, a berry, no? So it can be smaller as well, and like a small finger tip. So it's but it has a form of an olive, on the shape. It's not an aromatic wine, kind of. It's not an aromatic.
It's not that aromatic, but it's got a nice mouthfeel.
Yeah, it has an enormous.
It's got a teeny bit of bitterness, but like good bitterness.
Yeah, it has a lot of minerality. No.
Yeah.
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 It's more on the structure and on the minerality, kind of.
What's if you're sitting there looking at the ocean, what's a good food to eat with this? Any kind of seafood, shellfish?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, but it's funny sometimes with Ansonica, it's kind of also interesting to eat kind of meat. No,
because yeah, I think it has the structure in the body for that.
Yeah, because you know the culture of the island was not really a sea culture; it was a farmer culture.
Oh, farmers. So they were eating everything, right?
Yeah, so they used to have this wine with meat and with the
That makes sense culturally and the type of wine it is. Tell me a few things. Tell me about your farming practices. You know, obviously you've grown up around the 2 hectares. You know, you have a handful of vineyards. You know, you recently acquired one. What do you seek out? I mean, are you looking for organics, biodynamics, sustainability? You know, you sound like a very sensible guy. I don't think you want to walk into vineyards that are heavily treated. So, you know, what's your approach to all of this?
Well, listen, my approach is It's very simple, you know. I have a strong attention for quality.
Okay.
No? So this means automatically now, you know, the less you treat, the better it is. The more clean your fruits are, the better your wines are. I mean, it's an equation, no? So we are doing 100% organic agriculture, no? But not for quality reasons, no? Rather more for, you know, making our part on keeping this world clean, no? Let's see.
Well, that's as important. What you put in your stomach is important as what you do to the earth. So, I mean, it plays both ways, right?
Yeah. So that's kind of the drive for why we actually do organic agriculture.
Okay.
My drive is to do quality agriculture.
Order to attain quality, you can get there organically, right? Because some people have to treat to get to the quality they think they need to. That's not how you think, right?
I think quality is you need to spend a lot of time in the vineyards. You need to do things by hand. You need to do, I mean, when before I decided to become organic in 2010. I remember 2002, 2003, I started having my first visit in the vineyards by other winemakers. And they asked me if I was organic. And I asked them, why? They asked me, yeah, because there is so much hand care in your vineyards. You're doing all this.
I mean, they thought it was obvious to them that you probably are because of the way you were doing it?
Yeah, because of the way that so much time I was using in the vineyards to create beautiful fruits, no?
Right.
And I was not at all organic, you know? I mean, I was not even, so also when I changed from non-organic to organic, for me it was not a problem at all.
Because hard, right? It
was not hard at all. Because when you are doing a quality agriculture, you are in the vineyard. You stay in the vineyard, you spend time in the vineyard, you follow your grapes,
best wines come from the vineyard, BB. We agree on that, which leads me to the next thing. So now you're in the cellar. You mentioned a word before, intervention, you know, where you don't intervene a lot. Do your cellar practices mirror, you know, how you approach the vineyards? I mean, do you don't screw around too much in the, tell me what you do in the cellar.
No, cellar is the lowest intervention is possible. No, it's the work is done in the vineyard. The cellar is to keep up to the work that you did in the vineyard. So it means to try to preserve as much as possible of the characters of the soils, of the lands, of the terroir, you know. So you must, so that's why we don't use new wood or very, very little new wood. We use very, very little sulfites. Every time we add some sulfites, we check the wines. We check every single barrel before we make an adding. So
are you able to get away with indigenous yeast?
Yeah, we only use indigenous yeast.
Okay.
No,
that's great.
No, but it's just a matter of quality again there, because we made that, we tried, and the wine were better. No,
so, yes, so, I think in the end that's usually what happens. I don't curse a lot on the show, even though I curse a lot in life. But you really don't give a shit about regulatory organizations like the DOC and the DOCG. Why is that? It just hampers the way you want to make your wines.
I don't know. It just doesn't appeal me.
Why?
The idea.
You don't need to do that.
I don't know. Maybe it's a matter of character. No, I'm always been a very autonomous guy. No.
Yeah. So that's not autonomy. Those organizations. So it hasn't affected really anything, right? I mean, you don't get any pushback or any problems.
Well, you know,
a little.
It would be probably easier, no, if I would be a Brunello, or if I would be a Barolo, or if I would be something like that. In a sense, with my kind of work and my kind of recognitions, probably if I would also have a DOC behind me, it would be
right. Are you getting to the point where you've established yourself, where you worry about that less? You know, people know the name Testamada Calore. They know.
I actually never worried about it. Okay. I just.
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, if you're not going to get involved with it, it'd be. I never worry about it.
The good thing about it, it's when I talk with all my, say, friends and winemakers that are in a DOC. They kind of envy me because they say, okay, you know what? At the end of the day, it's better to be out like you are.
I know. And nobody likes the BS or the nonsense, but no, there's good and bad.
The thing is that you are obliged to really create your name. You're not just hanging on a DOC. No?
Right. That's a very good point. And that,
which is not, which at the end of the day, whatever you do in life, you need to create your own thing. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
I agree with that, and that's how I see what you're doing. One last thing, and I have a thing called the wine list where I ask my guests a bunch of questions. I don't want to let you get out of here without doing it. You know, you are an artist. We talked about that. You create the labels for your wines. The labels, you know, how do we describe it? Is it like a form of impressionism or something? You know, they're pretty cool. Is that typical of the type of art that you were doing? Or you just sat down one day and had a vision that this is what you wanted the labels to look like?
No, I just had the feeling that I wanted to have the impression I had when I was putting my nose into a fantastic glass of wine and discovering a wine.
That was your inspiration.
Yeah, that was my inspiration for this label.
So are you still dabbling in art, or you're so busy that when you have to, it's for labels?
Yeah, I'm in that stage there now. I'm doing it when I do the labels, no? And
yeah, they're beautiful. And yeah. I think the real motivation is to try the wines because they're wonderful, but the labels are very, you know, catchy, and they're very beautiful. They're very elegant and simple, which is a nice thing. And the fact that it's your artwork, I would assume that the originals or some of them are around Aurora framed.
Yeah.
I would think so. All right, BB, we got to wrap up pretty soon. But before we do two things. I want you to answer my wine list. And before we leave, I want to taste the Calore with you. We got a chance to talk about the Testamata Bianco for a minute or two. All right, so I have five questions. I ask all my guests the same questions. Nothing different for you. Let's do this quickly. Don't dwell on your answers. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? What are you drinking besides your wines? What do you like to drink? You mentioned Burgundy earlier. Have you become a Burgundy drinker? Are you a beer guy? Does your taste change with the seasons? What's in your fridge now? What's on your table?
Well, right now I am having a nice beer.
Okay. So you like to have a beer every now and then. It's a good break, right? Yeah. Italian beers, imported, what?
Simple Italian beers. I'm not a fancy beer drinker.
Okay. No? Wines that you're curious about or you like to drink?
Yeah, well, we're always playing around and trying to taste new wines and things and see what other people are doing. It's a pleasure. No? So we're open to any kind of wines. And
does that tend to be more Italian, or it's as global as
No, it's kind of global.
Okay, very cool. So you're always tasting wines and you're having some beers. All right. Do you have, this is the silliest question on the list. Do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? Not what you think is a good pairing, but something you actually like. You know, you probably don't eat it every week, every month, you know, maybe a few times a year.
My favorite is Testamatta with strawberries and whipped cream.
Well, you said that because of the fruit and because of some of the wood, it tastes like that naturally. So yeah. You take something that tastes like that and then you eat it with the real thing? That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty good. I'm not sure I've ever had somebody answer that. All right, so I'm going to ask you this question, and I think probably because you travel a little, but not that much, you know, lately because of COVID and being busy. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? Is there any place around there where you could walk in and they have a cool wine list and the people there are knowledgeable and the vibe is good? Maybe there's some good food or snacks. There are a couple of places around you, go-to places?
Here in Florence?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's there are a couple of really cool places to...
But keep it in the context of great wine, too. Not the best restaurant, but restaurant and wine or wine bar.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here in Florence, probably one of the nicest place to go out for having wines is called La Giostra.
G-I-O-S-T-R-A?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a restaurant too, right?
Yeah, it's a restaurant.
I've eaten there. Terrific.
Yeah, it's because it's kind of a very nice atmosphere, but they have only outstanding wines.
So the wine list is great. You know what I noticed? You know, I've been there a few times and there's always people that walk in like from the U.S. or I always bump into somebody, you know, there. It's a very popular spot. All right. Anything else like that come to mind? What's going on at Aurora? Are you keeping a restaurant or the Bar Blue? What are you doing there?
There we are just now starting to an activity. We didn't really open up still.
Okay.
But we finished all the works and we're going to make our wine bar there.
All right, so that's soon to come. All right, so we'll put La Giostra down. All right, here's the fourth question. BB's favorite all-time wine. Now, when I initially asked my guest that, I wanted you to tell me the rarest, most expensive wine that you ever drank. What I care about is a wine that became important to you, that was an enlightening wine, that was a gateway wine, you know, that was something that shifted the way you thought. Now, you may have answered it with that Romani Conti, but that's sort of the, even though that's a very fancy, famous, expensive wine, it had a huge impact on your thinking. But is there anything else like that?
Well, I mean, that was definitely... It was not a Romani Conti, it was a Richebourg.
No? Oh, it was a Richebourg. Okay, my bad. Go ahead.
It was a Richebourg from Romani Conti.
Okay, so equally as good.
So that was definitely the wine that really turned my my vision, in making.
I mean, you said that, right? So, is there anything else similar to that along the way, or that was the one?
Not that strong in the sense of...
Well, that's a good one.
No?
So it's the Richebourg, and that changed your thinking how to... kind of wines you want to drink and make.
Yeah. Well, then,
here's the last question. And I think you can handle this. I want you to recommend to me a red and a white wine. It could be a region, it could be a maker, that costs about 15, 20, 22 American dollars. So what I'm asking for is, what's the best wine value you could think of in a white wine? What's the best wine value you could think in a red wine? I'll tip you off a little. I mean, are there Vermentinos from the coast?
I would say that there was one of the, I was very impressed by, I don't know which review was it that gave it as the best wine of the world. And it was the Prosecco of Franco Neri.
Huh? Okay.
Franco Negri.
So Franco Neri Prosecco.
Negri, yeah. That's Negri. A wine that cost less than $20.
And great value, great quality.
Fantastic, fantastic wine.
Okay, that's why I ask you these questions, because we like to turn our listeners on to stuff they may not have heard of. It's always harder to do a red. Can you think of a red in that vein?
I think maybe if you, I don't know if it's, it went higher up with the value.
Well, get me close.
No, the kind of like the Chianti Classico of Castello di Volpaia, for example. I don't know what the price is there.
I think you may be in the range. It may be 25. I think Chianti Classico is a home run and great value. So there may be a few guys in that. So you're saying Chianti Classico and you're saying Volpaia.
Yeah, Volpaia, because Volpaia is it's very high up in the mountains and they have this very, very fresh and transparent and elegant wines.
Right.
And so it's
so specifically
cool
the Volpaia. All right. I didn't mention this, but I post all these answers on our social media so our listeners have access to them. In the coming week, we'll be promoting the show and we'll be, putting those answers out there. All right. Great job on that. Before we wrap up, BB, we do a thing called the weekly wine sip where every week we taste the wine on air. It's always the best when our guest is the winemaker and we get to talk about and taste his wines. So this is a treat for me and it's nice to have you talk about it. So what I have in front of me is I have your, what they call your Mac Daddy wine. I have the 2020 Colore, which I want you to tell me a little about. We discussed it a little earlier, but I have it in the glass and I want to do some analytics like nose and palate and all that. But tell me a little, you know, a little more about the wine that you didn't tell me.
Well, you may put your nose in the glass, no? And
all right, so first of all,
the feeling.
We'll go right there. I'm looking at the color and when I poured it, I was surprised that it wasn't this deep, dark, brooding wine like I would expect from some Brunellos and even the Super Tuscans, which plays to your Burgundy influence. Am I clear? I mean, am I right?
Absolutely.
That it's sort of a...
It's all about, you know, it's all about transparency, acidity, fruits. No, you have this red fruits.
All right, so go to the nose. I got my nose in the glass. I suck at descriptors. What am I getting out of this 2020?
It's kind of what really strikes me in the 2020 Colore, the nose, it's this really subtle, but very delicate perfumes that are there. And
yes,
it's amazing. They're so delicate. They're so fine, no?
It's very aromatic. It's not overpowering in any one descriptor. It's very wide. It's beautiful. And it is, in a good way, a perfume aromatic, you know, a kind of accumulation of all the good things. All right. The mouthfeel to me is it's a medium, beautiful mouthfeel. It's not thin at all, but it's not this thick, glycerin-y, you know, unctuous wine. It's got a beautiful mouth-filling mouthfeel. Agree? Do you agree the mouthfeel is sort of a medium mouthfeel?
Absolutely. No, that's part of my philosophy of making wines. I want my wines to be drank. No,
right. It's this is a very deep. Drinkable as far
they
as...
They need to be gastronomic somehow. No? They need to be on a table and stand on the table and be able to be enjoyed without thinking too much also. No? Just drink a bottle of wine easy. No, whatever it is.
Yep. That I agree with that. Now, the last thing is the palate. Do the descriptors of the nose match the palate? What do you get on the palate? Is that where you get your strawberries and a little? Tell me what you get on the palate.
Well, you get all this, you get this freshness and this red fruits and the acidity, huh?
Yeah, I think the acidity is good, which makes it great for food. I think you're right about the red fruits. You know, it's more of a red fruit-driven wine than, you know, the darker fruits. What I'm curious about is 10 years from now, where do you think, how do you think this wine evolves? You never know, but what do you think?
I don't know. Well, the only thing I know that the wines that I've been doing up to now, like 2000, 2001.
Right, what's happening with them?
They're still young, no?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So they're highly ageable. That's great.
Yeah.
They don't need to settle down, but, you know, maybe they just change a little.
But it's a good question, Mark, because, I mean, they were done in a very super over-extracted way and very
powerful. You're talking two different wines.
So it's going to be interesting to see in 10 years what these wines are.
Right. Wine from 10 years ago today and this wine 10 years ago from now, you can't necessarily do a side-by-side. What's in your mind, classic pairings for this wine?
Well, you know, it's as I told you, it's a gastronomy wine, no? So
get it in front of food.
Get it in front of food, you know, that kind of easy. It's not you don't need to have a wild duck flying around, kind of. No?
It's right.
You can have it with whatever. Just have it with good company. That's the main thing.
Yeah, really. I mean, as simple as a nice juicy burger or a steak or even chicken fish, it goes with anything. It's a beautiful wine. I think it's a versatile wine as far as the gastronomy thing because it's not light and it's not heavy. It's somewhere in the middle and that goes with a lot. It's a beautiful wine. So that's the 2020 Colori, the BB Gretz Colori. The Tuscan wine with his, you know, own design label on it. All right, BB, we got to wrap up. I just want to do a quick wrap up, and then I want to get some info from you, and then I'm going to let you go. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to The Grape Nation on The Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your pods. The reason we ask you to subscribe is once you're a subscriber, the episode shows up and it's ready for you to listen. You're lying in bed and there's BB Gretz, who happens to be a very handsome man right next to you, ready to talk to you. Leave a review if you like the podcast. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby. And on Twitter at Ben Ruby. I know that's a little confusing, but you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation to find us on both. We are on Facebook at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we'll post BB's wine list answers, and I'll give you more information on our weekly wine sip and the white wine we tasted so that you could look it up. We'll be posting those on our social media sites. BB, if people want to get more information on your wines, what's the best way for them to go? Website? I mean, where, if people are like, these wines sound cool, this guy sounds great, I need to know more, what's the best thing?
Probably the best way is to go on our Instagram page, BB Gretz.
Okay, so you are active on social media. What's the Instagram page?
It's BB Gretz Winery.
BIBIGRAETZ, BB Gretz, at BB Gretz, right?
Yeah.
All right. So that, if you go there, you'll see a lot of stuff you post fairly regularly?
Yeah.
All right. So that would be the best place. And from there, you know, you'll find a lot of information. There's a lot of discovery on Instagram. so that sounds good. You also have a website. You can go to BB Gretz and there's a website. And you could see the labels that we're talking about. You can get the descriptions of the wines. You can get technical info and all that stuff. So you can do that too. All right, BB, I want to thank our guest, BB Gretz. I want to thank our engineer, Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.